It was quite a treat this week to work with this text that was preached in 1983 by Roy Jones, who served this church for over a decade. And so my offering to you today is kind of a reimagination, taking the words that he wrote, the stories, the ideas, and kind of bringing it into maybe how I would preach a sermon of that content. The 8:30 heard me stumbling through all of Roy's words. So today you get to hear me stumbling through his ideas. I want to begin, though, with the same meditation that Roy offered at the beginning of his sermon. May our hearts and minds be open to leap over boundaries of tongue and hear the universal word of love that speaks in them. For this is the source of hope, now and ever. Amen. There's a story that's not really in the Bible, but could have been in the Bible, about Noah. The rain had begun. It had flooded the whole world, and there he was with his sons and all of the animals in the ark. They were gliding along one day. All they could see was water, until off in the distance they saw a speck of what looked like land. They drifted towards it, and they realized that it was, in fact, Noah's neighbor, who had somehow, during the flood, ran to the top of Mount Everest. Here's how you can tell it's not really in the Bible. And there he was, this friend, standing on his tippy toes, the water up to his chin. And he called out to Noah, "Help! Can you help me?" Now, Noah didn't know what to do. He went back to confer with his sons. I mean, God had made no mention of what to do in a situation like this. I mean, they didn't have any oars. They didn't have a rudder to move the boat. They didn't even have rope. I mean, it wasn't on the checklist of what to bring in the ark. Bring the animals, but not rope, apparently. And so they started to talk to each other. One of his sons says, "I can't even swim, so don't look at me." The other son said, "It's already a bit crowded in here, isn't it?" And so Noah turned, walked back outside, and shouted to his friend, "I'm sorry we can't help you, but if you stand there on your tippy toes for the next week or so, if it doesn't rain, you should be okay." Small comfort, right? Just stand on the top of Mount Everest for another week and you might be saved. A small comfort that the promises of help were in a future that left us in the present woefully stranded, caught in our dilemmas. I feel like many of us have been felt like we've been caught in a dilemma like that, caught in between time, told that the answers to our problems were somewhere else, in some other time, in some other place, and yet here we are then, still in the midst of our problems, wondering, so what do we do? Other times, we can become so focused on what is going on now that we somehow miss how quickly the now becomes the future. The now becomes the long haul. Where others of us can become so focused on the future that we tend to stress deferring satisfaction, forgetting that the now is the only time that we can act either to enjoy or to prepare for enjoyment. Both of these understandings of putting off to the future or focusing only on the now are very human ways of coming to grips with what Roy calls the contingencies of life, the reality that, as the Buddha says, all things pass. All things are transient. And as humans, one of the bedrocks of our condition is that we are caught living in this contingent world, living in the reality of life that we have a present and a future, both uncertain, and we have to survive in between. So for many of us, the uncertainties of what is to come, even the uncertainties of our present dilemmas, it moves us to seek faith. To seek something that will provide a buoying support, maybe a life rope, coming from an ark to save us. But especially for Unitarian Universalists, a word like faith can be a little bit sticky, right? And religions for centuries have asked people to have faith with dangerous repercussions. But Roy, in his sermon, offers a really beautiful definition of faith for Unitarian Universalists. He offers a work-a-day description of faith that says, faith is that posture of trust which opens access to whatever real reinforcements for meaning or sources of initiative or direction there are. Faith is the trust that opens these things to us. I want to say that part again. Faith is a posture of trust. A posture of trust which opens access to whatever real reinforcements for meaning or sources of initiative or direction there are. That faith is not blind acceptance, but rather is a trust that opens these things, these resources, these initiatives, these directions to us. And I love that. I love that definition of faith because it's broad enough for those of us who have a conception of God to live in and for those of us who don't have a conception of God. Because what faith in this concept allows us is to ask the question, what do you trust? What in this world, in this reality, do you rely upon? And what does that unlock within you? How does that help you live your life in the present moment? Whatever dilemmas, individual or collective, but also how does it help you live in that future, uncertain, and yet so contingent on what we do now? And so we must be asking ourselves constantly, what is worthy of us putting our trust in? Because to place our trust is a vulnerable activity. To place our trust in something says that when I need you, I should rely on you being there. To place our trust in something that is not actually there leads to a shock, an existential shock of failure, of dismay, of perplexity, of questions of what happened when we relied on something and it wasn't there. Questions like, did I do something wrong? Is what I trusted there or not? We might not think about this often, but we actually exercise faith every day. That's a good way of saying that. We may not think about it, but faith is a deep part of every one of our lives. And Roy offers this beautiful metaphor about faith and technology. He talks about faith and elevators. So you walk up to an elevator, and you push the button. And you stand there, and you wait, and nothing happens. What's the first thought that comes into your mind? Because usually for me, it's, I didn't press the button hard enough, right? And so you like press it again, kind of impatiently, seeing if the light should come on, or then you're like looking around to see if there's like another button to press. So imagine you're sitting there, and you've pushed it again, and the elevator still doesn't come. I might start wondering, has it broken down? Is it stuck on a floor? Maybe I've made a mistake and this building is actually closed, that there's a sign that said the elevator is broken that I've somehow missed, or that there's been a power failure, or that there isn't actually an elevator at all and this is just an illusion. Maybe I don't go there. But each of those moments is actually about faith. Because when we press the button to call the elevator, we're having faith in the designers of the elevator. We're having faith in the reliability of the power company. We're having faith in our own familiarity with the realities of what an elevator is and how to operate it. And so even if that time the elevator didn't come and you had to take the stairs or you realized you were in the wrong building or that it was broken, I'm imagining that the next time you walked into a building and needed to use an elevator, you would still press the button and you would still wait. Because that one moment of an elevator not coming wasn't enough. It wasn't enough of a shock to upend your faith in the general reliability of elevators. Having faith is about trust. And that one single existential shock to your assumptions wasn't enough to shatter that faith. I think the example of an elevator is useful because it showcases one of the profoundly complicated and yet essential aspects of human faith, which is that trust, that faith is a collective enterprise. I mean, I don't know how elevators work. Does anyone know? I mean, I know there's like a wait some of the time. I know that like if you cut the string, whatever it is, like the scientists have told me that I won't die. But like, I haven't met any of those scientists, have you? Like, have you met any scientists that have worked on an elevator? None of you have. Have any of you worked on an elevator in any capacity? One, two, okay, two people. And yet, how many of you fear elevators, like, remotely? Right. Why? I mean, you don't know how they work, really. Right, it says something about faith, because we, as a human species, develop a faith that is collective. Right? We put our faith in other people's faith, in other people's knowledge, in other people's experiences. And so we trust that there were scientists, engineers, and people that have made that elevator safe. We do trust that even if the elevator didn't come that one time, that the people responsible for the building will rewire the button and make sure it'll come the next time. We do trust that faith and trust is a collective exercise. And there are moments in our culture where that collective exercise of trust and having faith is easier than others, right? There have been moments probably for you in your life where it's been easy to trust foundational assumptions about life. And then there have been moments, and I know for many in this congregation, moments recently in which it's been hard to find trust in other people, where we feel suddenly isolated because the assumptions, the trust that we had in other people and the way they would act in society is suddenly cut from underneath us. The experience of many people, especially white liberals, after the election in 2016, I think is emblematic. That for many white liberals, the conception that progress was at least somewhat inevitable was cut from below. The rug was pulled out from under them. These foundational assumptions, this faith, that people wouldn't do what they did, suddenly left us without breath, fearing that everything, maybe, that we believed was true was no longer. That's the danger of this reality of a collective faith, is that when we put our trust in other people, when they let us down, it can lead us to isolate and disconnect. What's fascinating about the 2016 election is that when you talk to people of color in this country, they were not surprised by the 2016 election. The idea that America was a country that was moving towards positive reforms, that would not do something like elect Trump, was not within their collective experiences. The trust that they had was not in that wouldn't happen. The trust was that they would be resilient enough to survive yet again. And so when we think about faith, one of the fascinating components of faith, if it is a collective enterprise, is where is our faith incubated? Because if our faith is incubated in the familiar, if our faith is incubated in insular communities in which everyone looks like us, thinks like us, acts like us, then our faith is weak. Our faith is generated in these moments of exchange with people who are completely different from us, whose fundamental assumptions about reality are drawn from different resources, that their direction comes from a different set of circumstances, then our faith, for it to survive, has to adapt. Now, religion for many people has been a proxy for this sort of trust. We go to church, we practice our faith as a way of answering some of these painful and existential questions about life. Why is there suffering? Where will I go when I die? And for many religions, the answer is to forestall the answer. Things will be made clear in another life. Mourning the death of a friend, the poet Tennyson could say, "Oh, yet we trust that somehow good will be the final goal of ill." That is a statement of faith, not fact. A faith that many religious communities offer to one another. And there is a comfort in that. But of course, the question is, A, what about right now? If healing is only someplace else in some other time, what about now? But then also, is it true? Is it true that in some other time or some other place it would in fact be better? I'm sure there are many of us who sit in this room filled with our own lives, our own pain for the world, questions about our jobs and whether we should quit or whether we should go back to work, questions about our family and relationships. Is it really worth trying again to reconnect? Is it really our path to try to mend that bridge? Or maybe questions about the future. Should I really start a family in a time like this? What does it mean to be living now? Roy, in his sermon, speaks about how in the Christian faith, Jesus is used as a way of helping us in these moments. He tells a story of a Sunday school teacher who tells a young child that that they won't fall on the swing because Jesus wouldn't let them. Right, of course, that creates an existential crisis for the child when she does fall. But it's that sort of story that can be really comforting for us. And for many in our culture, Jesus is this kind of sum total goodness. All of the personal experiences we've had of compassion and kindness get personified into this character of Jesus that we can interact with or we can invoke into our lives. And for other people, the word God, or in the Christian word, the word God, is this kind of culturally coded word that is kind of an image of cosmic support. So like the Jesus image, it's rooted in some sort of astonishing reality. But in this case, the word God kind of answers that question, what accounts for you being here now? I'm going to quote from Roy's passage. Words are powerful. They are both the imprisoners and releasers of meaning. Words are bound to the cultures of their origin and to their limitations. They are continuously being confronted with the realities to which they can, at best, only point, never wholly define. There is no more intrinsic holiness or power in the multicultural word God, for example, than there is starch in the word potato. Beautiful phrase, right? There is no more intrinsic holiness in the word God than there is starch in the word potato. And yet, by whatever name, starch and vitamins are essential to our nourishment. And there is something behind the word God that is nourishing and needed for us as humans. Roy goes on, the cosmos, the universe that has conceived and nourished the human possibilities and that has brought you into being in particular, that cosmos is still here. The family of persons in whose community your personhood has emerged, the family of persons is still here. The possibilities, the potentialities, which are singularly yours by virtue of your unique and unrepeatable being, are still present and still worthy. And there is some force within us, some sort of yearning to grow towards something that directs ourselves towards the caring of other people, the intelligent community of others, which is real in us and real in others. What I feel like Roy is getting at in this passage is he's telling us in this contingent life in which the present and the future collide together, where the dilemmas of life are not easily dismissed as being solved into some future, that we need a source of faith, something that we can trust that will help us navigate that which is sturdy beyond the present realities of our days. And he offers us a source of faith in the very nature of the universe, the nature of the universe that conspired to bring you here and conspired to bring us together, that constantly allows for more and more possibilities to emerge. He in fact says that there is a trust that we can have, that we are not alone or not need not be, that we can trust that community offers us a place not to sacrifice our integrity, but to sustain it. That there is a nest of possibilities that brought us here, and that this source of faith tells us that branching from this moment, there are many possible futures. But he goes on to say that our trust, our faith, isn't something that will give us some magic rescuing power. Just believing, just having faith does not give you the life rope, the life raft that man needed in Noah's story. Our trust opens us, though, to the real reinforcements of meaning, the sources of initiative and direction that there are. What it does is it liberates us. A deep trust in the abiding power of the possibilities which brought you here, Roy says, will not bestow force or power upon you that you do not have, but it will help to liberate in you the powers that you do have. And they are probably greater than what you ordinarily consider. For how intimidated we are in thousands of ways from drawing on the full measure of growth and flexibility, ingenuity, cooperation, and love that are our general, human, and individual, personal bequests. We need to trust something that unlocks the truth within us, that our agency is meaningful, that our part of the truth is worthy, that the world where belovedness is the path and the destination is our way, and that we need to be that trust for each other when the road gets hard. Amen, and blessed be.